small group of people, if they are dedicated, if they remain steadfast, if they believe in their cause and their cause is a just cause, it might take a little bit of time, but surely they will overcome and they will be victorious even upon a larger host. Taking it from a very general, you know, in my own words perspective, which I put forth, but if you look at the Holy Quran, it says the same thing, right? That how many a small host has overcome a very large host, and what is the differentiating factor? It's not weapons and power and money and these kind of things. It's remaining steadfast, remaining on the correct path, being patient in the adversity, continuing to move forward, and fighting for a just cause. These small groups, you know, back in the day, were fighting a huge propaganda machinery which was being pushed by the Zionist powers and pro-Zionist lobbies. I mean, even today, these Zionist lobbies are humongous. Mm. And the fact that they're losing this propaganda war or this war of information is really, I think, one, humiliating for them. Despite
all those resources that they have at their disposal.
I mean, yeah, the resources, the amount of global leaders that are in their pockets, you know.
The government supporting them.
The central banks that these people.
The intimidation, let's not forget that as well. The intimidation, the police forces are on their side. Mm-hmm. The system is actually on their side, and yet.
And despite all this, you find that this small group of people who were standing up for the just cause of Palestine, and the cause of Palestine itself is just. Just go and read the history about it. They stood up, they stayed steadfast, and you have seen that the tide has turned. And now, more so than in solidarity of the Zionist state, the world is now in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
So coming back to Sheikh Ali, this idea of them having lost, essentially, the soft war, at least the previous battles, they've lost them. Are we saying that that's the main factor and cause in why they are censoring these predominantly Shia media
course,
outlets?
Of course, if you look at the enemy, they don't want the masses to, you know, wake up, right? That's one of the agendas of the mainstream media, to keep them in slumber, keep them sleeping, you know, just be irrelevant in this whole equation of, you know, truth versus falsehood and righteousness versus falsehood, the haq and batil. They want them to be just indifferent, right? Just focus on your own life, because it goes with their whole philosophy of life and the outlook they have towards the world and the life, where they say that you're a social animal who should only be concerned with your own needs and wants, you know, just stay there and no need. While when you look at Islam, for instance, or even human logic, right, we cannot be indifferent about a person dying on the street. Mm. We cannot be indifferent about, you know, a pregnant woman not reaching the hospital. We cannot be indifferent about a neighbor who is suffering, right?
It's this just is the true human definition of a social life.
Right.
Their definition is a contradiction, as you
right.
said.
So what these media outlets, you know, especially the ones who are banned, I don't know about all of them, because I haven't really studied all of them, but at least a few I know of, which were news reporting websites and satellite channels, they are banned because due to their activities and because what they were putting out there, and they were informing people, the masses were waking up. Mm-hmm. Waking up against oppression, waking up against tyranny, waking up against these control that the Western hegemonic governments have had over them for decades, if not centuries, right? They were waking up to the reality of so-called liberal democracy, you know, the last 200 years phenomena, you know, it's just like a hoax, you know, where people were made to believe that you have a say, you have a right, you have. No, you don't have right, you don't have say, you don't have freedom of expression, you don't have freedom of speech in the West. You look at the academics who were not even Muslims, right? In some cases, they were Jewish people, right? These academics, their careers were ruined because they exposed the Western treachery and their plots, and especially the evil nature of the Zionist regime of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Their academic careers were destroyed. Well, he's a teacher, he's a professor, right? Norman Finkelstein, for instance, you know, so on and so forth. There are too many of them, right? It's just one example.
And even people who weren't associated with the idea of Palestine, so to speak, but people like Julian Assange, who were just pointing out that, look, the flaws of the Western imperialistic system, even they're imprisoned.
Right. Now they're feeling vulnerable. Now the West is feeling vulnerable. They've put together something over the course of last 200 years, which is called the liberal democracy and its affiliated apparatus. They're feeling that it's vulnerable. People are not going to get tricked into and take it as at its face value. People are standing up, challenging that system, right? You saw, like, even with the so-called democracy, how people opposed the elected government and the Trump era and the transition to Biden. You saw that, right?
Fiasco. The storming of the Capitol is a huge historical event.
Right? So now they're seeing that we're weak. They're seeing that the masses are waking up. They're seeing that it is not that we can just put out a multi-million dollar news reporting website or a TV channel or a satellite channel and the masses will be fooled that easily.
Or even that the movies that they make are going to completely, put out their propaganda. Exactly. You know, you have superhero movies presenting the American military as the good guys and stuff. Right. So people are even waking up to the cracks
now
in that.
Now, the question is, connecting it back to your question, with all this in mind, who made it all happen? How did the masses wake up? It is because of projects like Press TV. It is because of projects like Al Alam. It is because of projects like Al Masira, right? These are the projects which are run by human beings, not by robots. Like, their setups are being run by, you know, the machine-built artificial intelligence-based censorship and all that. No, these are human beings who are interacting with other people. And when that sentiment gets put out there in form of news, it has an effect on people. And because they were being effective in exposing the plots of the tyrants and the oppressive governments, they are silenced. Because that's all the West can do. They just know how to silence others, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes countries, sometimes governments, sometimes media channels, sometimes... Look at the crackdown that happened on social media profiles right after the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, right? People who had established profiles, 10 years, 12 years old profiles, they were wiped off their platforms.
Yes.
From Facebook, from Twitter, from YouTube, from Instagram, you know, so on and so forth. Now what we're seeing, this recent wave, is targeting those channels which are on satellite. So when it comes to social media, many of these channels of spreading the truth, they were removed. Now it's the turn of the satellite channels, Press TV and Al Masira and Al Alam and all that.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join them all in praising you. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I feel alive and I feel so good. I feel so close to you.
Smears, lies, and Islamophobia. Just a few of the criticisms hurled at the BBC following the release of a controversial documentary. Released in 2019, the 54-minute program seeks to expose what it claims are Shia clerics acting as pimps and sexual exploitation of vulnerable Iraqi widows under the gaze of Shia Islam's religious authorities. However, after the film's release, Iraqis responded negatively, furiously condemning the documentary and even petitioning for its removal.
You can't attack the doctrine because the abuse of ignorant people or those who are corrupt.
Those who look at this documentary will have the fuel and will have the somehow justification for themselves to incite others to attack Shias.
There are authorized people you can ask, but you come to dirty humans and ask them instead.
So I decided to travel to Iraq, meet those who spoke with the BBC, and investigate why so many Iraqis felt betrayed rather than saved by the BBC.
BBC Deceit.
The majority of the filming for Iraq's secret sex trade took place here in Qadamiyye. Located in Iraq's capital city, Baghdad, Qadamiyye is considered one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. The main mosque, which contains the resting place of two of Shia Islam's holy imams, is featured throughout the program. Now, these holy sites for Shia Muslims are supervised by the Ataba religious authorities. However, the program suggested that the Ataba and these holy sites were somehow linked or maybe even responsible for the criminal acts that they recorded on film. The BBC's investigation begins with an attempt at explaining muta, a form of temporary marriage permitted during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. Using undercover filming, the BBC then exposes what it claims were clerics acting as pimps and using muta to run a sex racket. But scholars I spoke to on the subject explained it very differently.
What can you tell me about muta marriage?
Temporary marriage was known at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, practiced by the Sahaba. So, it was something for certain circumstances. And in brief, when a student goes, for example, for study abroad for 3-4 years and needs some sort of, the natural urges to be fulfilled, he cannot go for permanent marriage, so they try to do this.
There's no difference between permanent and temporary marriage except for the time and dowry. Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful, gave all the decision-making for marriage into the lady's authority. And if her guardian tries to ban her from marrying someone who's good and honest, they don't have the right to do this, especially if she's older and wise enough to take care of herself. The contract is never complete without her permission.
But this wasn't the only issue which offended so many. What really bothered the many critics was the BBC linking Iraq's highest religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani, to sexual exploitation. Beloved by millions of Muslims worldwide and accredited with saving Iraq from terrorism, for Iraqis, seeing Sayyid Sistani questioned alongside low-ranking criminals went down badly with viewers.
It's very offensive. It's completely unacceptable. And that is why we wrote to the BBC and we highlighted that such association is completely unjustifiable and can never be accepted at all. Here is a man who has worked tirelessly to ensure that the rights of women are indeed looked after. And he himself has issued a number of instructions and decrees for the protection and preservation of the of women, and he condemned such practices as well. You know, when he was asked by the BBC itself, he issued a statement which said this is unacceptable.
During my travels, I headed down to the holy city of Karbala in southern Iraq. Karbala is one of the holiest places for Shia Muslims, with millions visiting its grand mosques every year to pay their respects to the Prophet's grandson Imam Hussein, who was martyred at this location 1,300 years ago.
What an amazing place. Just take a look at the background. Whether you're Sunni or Shia, you're going to love the architecture and the beauty of this grand mosque. Regardless of which sect you belong to, this place is beautiful.
The BBC came here too and spoke with Sheikh Ahmad Al-Asadi to see if the Ataba organization, which administers the holy sites, condoned the practice.
They came to us to ask about our locations for marriage services and our procedures and services. During the conversation, we discussed mutter marriage. But when you look at the finished BBC program, it focuses on illegal sexual businesses. From what they showed when they came to Ataba, they wanted to send a message to the world that Islam insults women, an issue which the West has actually, treating women as objects of lust for money. For us, marriage is a holy process. The BBC has no right to bring what the West believes about women and apply it to us.
Despite providing the BBC with detailed answers to their questions, Sheikh Al-Asadi's talk was edited down to an astonishing 28 seconds in the entire one-hour program.
The ones who interviewed us were not honest. They didn't transfer anything we discussed. The interview lasted 35 minutes, but they were not professional and they didn't use most of what we discussed. They transferred just what they wanted and left the rest behind. The BBC treated us without justice or in a professional way. They treated us like an intelligence agency would treat an interrogation suspect. The Ataba was targeted in this program after Grand Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa to fight Daesh. They wanted to knock down the Ataba and show a black image about us.
The BBC clearly wasn't making any friends, but was the documentary trying to mislead people about Iraq?
After speaking to the same individual that the BBC spoke to here inside the Ataba, it is very clear that there is a degree of resentment towards the BBC for the type of filming that they did here. Obviously, this was an important subject which needed to be highlighted, but the problem is the BBC appears to have launched a character assassination campaign against the most senior figures here in Iraq, including the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani.
Following our talk, I decided to look into what these scholars are up to myself. In particular, the work spearheaded by the organizations associated with the holy mosques.
So, just one of the many things which the organization has set up to help deal with the people's needs is hospitals, in particular since the outbreak of the coronavirus. This, of course, has been vitally needed as the government in Iraq hasn't been able to fulfill the needs of the people, especially during a global pandemic which nobody anticipated would arrive.
I visited schools, hospitals, orphanages, universities, and charities, including ones that assist women who had lost loved ones during the horrific war against Daesh. None of this was shown by the BBC.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the wars who may have been abused too.
With so many discrepancies already being discovered, I wanted to find out what else the BBC had conveniently forgotten to mention. Back in London, I got in touch with Iraqi activists who had been rigorously researching the BBC's claims and findings. Due to fear of repercussions for their work, we have chosen to protect their identity. What they found was stunning.
We found more than 73 mistranslations within the documentary. One single documentary by one of the largest media corporations in the world. 73 mistranslations. None of the individuals who are accused of misconduct in the documentary are linked in any way to the shrines. None of those individuals have committed any of those crimes inside the shrines, or indeed with any cooperation with anyone from those shrines. The shrines and these criminals do not have any links, and yet the BBC were very clearly pushing this narrative to the audience that the shrines had something to do with this misconduct and this abuse and these crimes they were trying to report on. Again, shifting the focus away from the real criminals. What they have demonstrated is cowardice, or there seems to be a narrative they were following instead of the truth.
Many senior Muslim groups complained to the BBC following the documentary's release. However, the BBC's replies have been more than a little disappointing.
As a result of the investigation and the information we have gathered and the detailed analysis of the documentary, we started sharing our findings in a formal way to the BBC. We lodged a complaint to the BBC and said to them very clearly, laid down the details of the findings, including the mistranslation, including the factual errors they had, including the lack of balance and objectivity when they were representing information, including the way they failed the real victims by ignoring some really difficult areas of violence and abuse. But throughout the process, they were making corrections, to be fair to them. They were making corrections, of course, after millions had watched the erroneous, mistake-filled version. But even after they were making these corrections, neither did they admit nor did they announce that they were making the correction. So they did it in a very subtle and sneaky way.
They denied responsibility, they denied liability, and they completely let their credibility and their professional responsibility down.
After the program went live, anger in the community spread rapidly. Action was taken, including a petition to cancel the documentary and coordinated press releases.
And this indeed
Sheikh Mohammed Al-Hilli was one of the many prominent Muslim speakers who condemned the film as Islamophobic.
When you watch this particular documentary, is the an idea that somehow Shia Muslims are supportive of such practices, or at least they're silent about it. Of course, the other problem I had personally with the documentary is the lack of representation and the opportunity for scholars who are able to speak English, or at least from the Shia community, to present their opinion regarding what was going on.
Despite the information being provided to the BBC of their inaccuracies, no action was taken to correct the issues, despite the BBC's promises to do so. Another prominent voice of damnation came from Ayatollah Milani, known and respected in both Iraq and the UK. He informed me that the BBC had an obsession with Mutta going back years.
This is unfortunately not the first time that BBC does that. 5 years ago, they interviewed me about the temporary marriage. And in details, I explained the history of that and all the principles of that in a very clear way. I provided the presenter with a copy of my book, Islamic Family Law, where a chapter in that is discussing in details the whole idea and concept of temporary marriage. But unfortunately, when they produced it and it was broadcasted, I found that a lady was interviewed, and she said after my work and my interview that temporary marriage is like prostitute. And when they asked me, I mean the producer of this BBC video, when they asked me about my opinion and to interview me, I said, look, I have a very bad experience from the previous time.
All this was enough to upset Iraqis, but I noticed other issues yet unhighlighted. The fact that the BBC continuously mentioned irrelevant points, such as the criminals claiming to be descended from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, combined with the journalist using her own personal views, such as claims that Sharia law grants fewer rights to women, add that with the use of subliminal messaging, such as the constant use of mosques and holy sites throughout the entire programme, all appears to be aimed at convincing the audience that Islam is an oppressive religion. Now, that's very interesting, given the fact that the programme also failed to mention, even once throughout the entire hour-long documentary, the 2003 British-supported invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, that is very interesting, given that the invasion totally destroyed the country, impoverished millions, and left so many vulnerable to criminal elements in society, particularly Iraqi women. But would the BBC do all this knowingly? I spoke to one former BBC staff member to find out. Can the BBC honestly claim that they are impartial?
One of the things that the BBC says when it's espousing its vision around the world, usually through the arm of BBC World Service, it's the idea that we are objective, we are impartial, and we are unbiased. These things cannot be true when you're dealing with the news. Sometimes there's a guilty party, sometimes there's an innocent party. Through omission, through a choice of whether or not to include a particular voice, to downplay a particular voice, or even the omission of a particular story, you're making it quite clear what side of the argument you're on. Now, when I worked for the corporation, like most of the journalists who were employed, I was there on a freelance basis. I was there as a presenter, as a producer in the London section. And you saw policy-making decisions. When I oversaw decisions being made, they were clearly done through a chain of command. So you couldn't just come up with a story and independently go and deal with it. You would have to go through an editor, through a producer, perhaps even through a line manager. Lawyers would check over your content from time to time. I mean, we'd even have the pronunciation department call you up and say, that's not quite how you say that name. Now, all of these things are being done for checks and balances, but they're also being done with one eye on, is this the kind of stuff we want to run? Is this the kind of stuff that will make us look bad? Does this represent core BBC value stuff?
Back in Kardemir, I decided that the only thing missing from my investigation was the criminals themselves. So before leaving Iraq, I decided to try and find those involved in abusing the Mutah practice.
Now, the way it was described at the time by the journalist reporting in the documentary was like she was almost entering into a red light district. It was a shady area which did questionable marriage services. But actually, on the contrary, there is a very family atmosphere here. This place is, you know, where people bring their children to come and visit one of Shia Islam's holiest sites. There are markets here, many shops, and Iraqi society is very conservative. So for anyone to be conducting practices which could be compared to prostitution openly in a place like this would certainly not be tolerated by the local community or by the authorities which patrol this area on a day-to-day, 24-hour basis.
Speaking to locals, it became immediately clear that those exposed by the BBC had a poor reputation to begin with.
They just brought someone from the street. He is not educated in the religion. When you want to talk about anything, you need to bring a specialist.
It wasn't long before we found the brother of Raad, Ravad Al-Kabur. Raad was one of the men exposed by the BBC in their documentary. Ravad agreed to speak to us about the BBC and his brother's conduct.
My brother has no office or license. He's not authorized to do any marriage contract. These people, they just lied to say something bad about Raad and Islam. If I see anyone doing unlicensed mutter marriage, I would insult them and their great-grandfathers.
After attempting to defend his brother, we asked if he would bring us to Raad for further scrutiny. Raad, however, refused to show himself. We also failed to track down Sheikh Salawi, who was also filmed by the BBC. However, we were told by researchers that he was not a recognized scholar and didn't represent any mosque, Ataba, or Sistani's office.
Our investigation took multiple dimensions. One of the dimensions was to go on the ground and identify those individuals. Who they are? Who do they represent? What qualifications do they have? Do they really exist? And that investigation very quickly uncovered that someone called Sayyid Raad was not a Sayyid. He has absolutely no qualification, no religious background, yet he was represented by the BBC as a cleric. We told them that, by the way, you haven't done your due diligence by looking after who these people are. But they denied that and said, no, we have done our due diligence. We asked to see evidence of that, but they failed to answer.
Documentary, in as far as presenting this, is not necessarily, we are not necessarily in any shape or form objecting to the presentation of this abuse. But we have to remember this, that in many war-torn countries, such abuse takes place. This is no justification. But it doesn't matter whether you're Shia, you're Sunni, you're Hindu, you're Jew, you're Christian. This kind of practice happens all around the world, and it's wrong, it's completely unacceptable. But to somehow continuously frame it to be a Shia thing, which the name of the documentary, which the documentary itself continuously sought to do, was something that, of course, we are completely unhappy with. And we voiced our concerns through legitimate means, through a very well presented and researched document, which involved research in Iraq, to go and speak to offices where somehow these rogue elements were working and issuing marriage certificates to young children and so on, where we've investigated how these people who are doing it have no relation whatsoever with the seminary, have no relation whatsoever with the clerical establishment, have no relation whatsoever with Ayatollah Sistani. They just happen to be criminals.
Now, of course, no one would have a problem with the BBC over its coverage of women being mistreated in Iraqi society. Obviously, it is a problem, and regardless of who covers it, it is, of course, something which is greatly important. However, the problem with the programme is that it seems to have purposefully missed out key aspects of the story here in Iraq. The way in which the film was styled seems to suggest that the Iraqi religious leadership has purposefully neglected Iraqi women, especially those most in need, and has also failed to police the practice of muta or temporary marriage, both of which is actually not the case, as we've seen in our time here in Iraq.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Under the guise of prosperity and the ridiculous pretense to be helping Palestinians, the ruling monarchs of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have done further damage to the Palestinian cause, becoming direct collaborators in the Israeli settler colonial apartheid project. We now present you an article written jointly by Denijel Jejic and Iqbal Jassat. The piece is titled "The Failure of Zionist Normalization." The inauguration of the Israeli embassy in Bahrain and the celebration of Israeli apartheid at the Expo 2020 in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, are the latest manifestations of the violent alliance between the three oppressive regimes, which has been advertised as normalization. This increased public collaboration is a necessity for Israel, but despite an exhaustive propaganda campaign, it will not help legitimize the regimes nor prevent their decline in the long run. The formal US-backed publicization of the relations between the regimes of Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain in August of 2020, also known as the so-called Abraham Accords, has highlighted how these oppressive regimes increasingly depend on one another. The announcement was celebrated as alleged progress towards so-called Arab-Israeli peace in West Asia, as if a war had ended. Of course, the regime in Tel Aviv and the ruling monarchs in Abu Dhabi and Manama were never really in any conflict. The unelected Persian Gulf dictatorships and the apartheid colony can be seen as natural allies, given that their existence in their current forms necessitates continuous oppression and existentially depends on America's support. The solidarity between the regimes is becoming crucial for their survival. The normalization of the Israeli regime has been advertised as beneficial for Palestinians, though a recycling of Zionist euphemisms of conflict and lies about imaginary peace talks and two-state solution. Under the guise of prosperity and the ridiculous pretense to be helping Palestinians, the ruling monarchs of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have done further damage to the Palestinian cause, becoming direct collaborators in the Israeli settler colonial apartheid project. Yet they lack any democratic mandate from their own populations. Emiratis and Bahrainis did not elect these despots, nor did they consent to normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Laws in the United Arab Emirates forbid organizing and protesting. Criticism of the normalization could effectively lead to life imprisonment in the United Arab Emirates. A culture of fear has prevented citizens from opposing their regime's alliance with the Zionist regime. Despite the lack of freedom of speech, Bahraini citizens continue to protest against the regime's alliance with Israel. They face violent silencing from the Bahraini regime. Recently, regime forces brutally suppressed the demonstrations against the visit by the Israeli regime foreign minister to Bahrain. Yair Lapid arrived in Manama on the first commercial flight from the occupied Palestinian territories in order to inaugurate the Israeli embassy in Bahrain. The two regimes stressed their common anti-Iranian stance and the usual key myths used in the advertising of the so-called normalization, that is, peace, stability, and cooperation. Meanwhile, in Dubai, Expo 2020 represents a major propaganda opportunity and, in fact, necessity for both the Israeli and the Emirati regimes. The dictatorship has long developed Dubai into a hyper-capitalist hub, where despotism is presented as progress, whitewashed through money, technology and entertainment. The absolutist monarchy is using Expo 2020 to expand its glittery image, trying to hide its structural human rights violations at home and abroad, such as the systematic oppression of foreign workers in the UAE and war crimes in Yemen. Just like the Israeli regime, the United Arab Emirates invests enormous propaganda efforts to secure its legitimacy in the West. For example, the Expo is heavily promoted by the corporate media outlet CNN. The Israeli regime was particularly well received at the event. Israel can now whitewash its apartheid directly from Dubai. Indeed, the Palestinian boycott, divestment and sanctions, the BDS movement, reiterated its call for boycott of all events sponsored by the Emirati regime. Highlighting the violent alliance between the two regimes, the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions National Committee called for escalating worldwide pressure on the United Arab Emirates dictatorship to end its support for Israel's apartheid regime, its crimes in Yemen, and its horrendous human rights violations at home. On her recent visit to the United Arab Emirates, the Israeli Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked announced the implementation of visa-free travel by citizens of the two regimes. Ayelet Shaked, who is known for her cause for genocide of the Palestinian people, was impressed by the Emirati police and the surveillance in Abu Dhabi. The aftermath of the formal normalization has revealed how similar the three regimes are in fact. It has also shown their fragility. The normalization is most of all a transitional relationship between the United States and its proxy regimes. It is also an extension of the Zionist apartheid. In fact, it has expanded the Israeli military and surveillance apparatus to the Persian Gulf. Israeli spyware has been used to track and oppress dissidents. Israeli tourists are smuggling drugs and engaging in inappropriate affairs. The apartheid regime's police will soon be establishing a permanent presence within the United Arab Emirates. Israel is weakened. As the U.S. hegemony in Western Asia seems to be in decline, the normalization with Arab regimes is becoming crucial for Israel's continued survival. The settler colonial regime is constantly on the edge, having to please its enablers and justify its mere existence, which continuously necessitates both the genocidal removal of Palestinians and enormous propaganda efforts. However, settler colonial and apartheid cannot be normalized, neither can the despotic rule in the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain. For decades, the people in the region have rejected any rapprochement with the Zionist regime and continue to do so today. Throughout West Asia, the resistance against the multiple Zionist regimes in the region is prevailing. Furthermore, pinning Palestinians down while applying harsh measures of violent repression accompanied by a fanatical settler movement of arch-racists, given free rein to attack and plunder, it is a notorious game that the Israeli regime has elevated on a daily ritual. In fact, the routine of inflicting war crimes has all the hallmarks of a rogue regime entirely caught up in a misplaced belief that to engage in ethnic cleansing is a religious obligation. Conflating Judaism with a racist political ideology of Zionism has been part of a strategy designed to deceive, distort, and divert. It has its roots in the First Zionist Congress held on the eve of the 19th century. That this is well documented and widely known is not in dispute. Indeed, awareness of Zionism's goal to dismember and dislodge Palestinians from their centuries-old homeland and forcibly impose thereon a foreign entity known as Israel has always been a bedrock for resistance. Israel has thus always been considered an enemy thrust upon a native population through the most horrific forms of terrorism. The memories of Deir Yassin remind the world of bloody massacres committed by Zionist terrorists which didn't spare hundreds of villagers to colonize Palestine. That more than seven decades later, the expansionist goals of Zionism are still being pursued at great human cost to successive generations of the indigenous Palestinian population is reflected in daily atrocities. None of these facts has been attested to by historians as well as organs of the United Nations and are contested. Though, of course, Israel and supporters of it seek to distort and malign commentators who speak truth to power as anti-Semitic. Yet against this background of terrorism and current conditions, siege, occupation, killings and mass imprisonment, recorded and broadcast by a mainstream media for all the world to witness, it is bizarre that a handful of Arab regimes have broken rank with Palestine's freedom struggle. The treachery associated with what has become known as normalization is an outrageous manifestation of betrayal and collaboration. Limited to the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, these regimes have in effect confessed that the protection of their shaky thrones counts for more than legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. Though the abnormality of implicit recognition of an illegal colonial enterprise has been in sharp contrast to countless Arab League resolutions, the deal of normalization pushed by Donald Trump and vigorously backed by the current Biden administration has exposed these leaders as surrogates of Western imperialism. The case of Bahrain's role in the Abraham Accords reveals the soft underbelly of Arab dictatorships. Besides being financially dependent on its neighbors, especially the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, Bahrain's alliance with the Israeli regime is designed to entrench its power and crush any resistance to authoritarianism or efforts towards freedom and democracy in Bahrain.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. The meaning of Bismillah according to the majority is different in each surah, each word, and each act. The jurisprudence say that the Bismillah must be defined for each surah. That is, if for a surah a Bismillah was recited, the next surah cannot be commenced with that same Bismillah. From the juristic point of view, this is not without reason. All Bismillahs have a single meaning.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Al-Khomeini was quoted saying that Muharram is a month during which people are up to hear the words of truth. Throughout the mornings that we hold for Imam Al-Hussein and all these gatherings and all these majalis, among the things that happens is that we have a spiritual development. As crying contributes to preparing the soul to receive spiritual and moral states, and crying works to wash the heart and purifies it from arrogance, cruelty, and various other diseases that prevent these spiritual states from reaching them. So accordingly, when these inhabitants are removed from the hearts, that they will be ready to receive these spiritual and moral perfections. So one, on a spiritual level, that when we gather, we attend these majalis, we put ourselves and elevate ourselves and develop our spiritual kind of side of things. When it comes to our moral development as well, that in addition to what we said when it comes to preparing the heart, it should be said that Ashura was full of moral meanings and values, which were manifested in the biography of Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi himself, in his family, in his companions. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. So it is necessary to emphasize on the statement and clarification of these values as they were manifested in their lives. So when I go to Karbala, when I go to the majalis, when I attend these ceremonies for Imam Hussein, when I cry and lament for him, I am trying to work on myself by spiritually and morally, by developing myself through listening to the truth. Because sometimes, if you are not going in the right direction, you could listen to someone that misguides you, that takes you somewhere else. So the hadith says, whoever listens to anyone that talks about shaitan, he will be worshipping the shaitan. If you listen to someone who talks about Allah, he will be worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So through Imam al-Hussein, through the majalis of Imam al-Hussein salamullah alayhi, we get to learn the truth as Imam al-Khomeini radhiyallahu alayhi said.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.